Hello, my name's Alan Stanford from Second Age Theatre Company, and welcome to Othello in Offaly.
This countercaster,
Iago!
Your daughter and the Moor are now making the beast with two backs.
Oh, my fair warrior!
Dear Othello!
A lascivious Moor!
Like a desert needs rain, like a town needs a name, I need your love.
Hold your hands!
Here's my husband.
Like a drifter needs a rain,
Iago!
I need your love.
Come, here's your order. I have but an hour of love.
I hate the Moor.
I need your love.
Fie upon thee, slanderer!
Look to your wife.
Cursed fate that gave thee to the Moor!
Arise, wrack vengeance!
Like a rhythm unbroken,
drums
in the night. Sweet soul music, like sunlight. Need your love.
Is not this man jealous?
The handkerchief!
Coming home, and you don't know where you've been.
Blood!
Lead, you are to blame.
Bless the Isle of Saints and the noble general of
In programme one, we're going to take a look at the opening scenes of the play to discover who are the characters, who are the protagonists, and how the plot begins to establish itself.
Tush, never tell me. I take it much unkindly that thou, Iago, who hast had my purse as if the strings were thine, shouldst know of this.
Splur, but you will not hear me. If ever I did dream of such a matter, abhor me.
Thou told me thou didst told him in thy hate.
Despise me if I do not.
Surprisingly, the first characters that we meet in the play Othello are neither of its two principal lovers, which are Othello and Desdemona. Shakespeare's cleverer than that. And the first people we meet are Iago and Rodrigo, the villain and one of his victims. Shakespeare very often does that. He'll begin a play by introducing one of the subplots rather than the main theme. He sort of pulls you into the play gently. Now, in this scene, we see Iago, who is, in fact, probably the most important character in the play. And interestingly enough, I think the longest character of any of Shakespeare's. Everybody thinks that Hamlet is the great, long, monstrous part, but Iago actually is a bigger part. It's a bigger part than Othello. In a way, it's the leading character of the play, because Iago is the main protagonist, and Othello and Desdemona are simply his victims. So even though the play is called Othello, even though it is about Othello and Desdemona, the story would not exist but for Iago. Iago is the character to watch. So in this very first scene of the play, we see Iago utilizing his most powerful gift, his power of persuasion. In this short scene, Rodrigo will be convinced by Iago of his hatred for Othello and his contempt for Cassio.
Three great ones of the city, in personal suit to make me his lieutenant, off cap to him, and, by the faith of man, I know my price. I am worth no worse a place. But he, as loving his own pride and purposes, evades them, with a bombast circumstance, horribly stuffed with epithets of war, none suits my mediators. For certes, says he, I have already chose my officer. And what was he? One Michael Cassio, a Florentine, that never set a squadron in the field, nor the division of a battle knows, more than a spinster. Mere prattle without practice is all his soldiership. But he, sir, had the election. He, in good time, must his lieutenant be, and I, God bless the Merrick, his Moorship's ensign.
Iago is a genius at deception, and he is a master of control. And most importantly, he is the most trusted character in the play. He is the one character in the play that everybody trusts, everybody believes in, everybody believes to be honest. And as we progress through the play, this becomes more and more apparent. If Iago has a nickname, it is Honest Iago. In this speech that we've just heard to Rodrigo, Iago tells nothing but the truth. It's one of the great rules of lying. If you really want to get away with a lie, make it the truth. Always find a way of telling the truth, but use it to your advantage. And Iago understands that skill quite brilliantly. I think everybody in the room in front of me seems to have a similar understanding of that. And that's important because you must recognize the fact that Iago is not just words on a page. He's a very real, living person. That's what makes great theater and why Shakespeare was a great playwright, because he put real people on the stage. And as you go through the play, you begin to realize that everybody knows something of an Iago. And let's not get too heavy about that, because Iago is possibly one of the most evil characters ever created by a playwright, and I hope you never come across a real one. But there is that little bit of deception in all of us, that little bit of self-seeking and self-regard and determination that we actually are slightly more important than everybody else. And it's on that factor that's within all of us that Shakespeare plays when he creates the role of Iago, and that's what makes him so attractive as a villain. We all sort of like him. And the other important point, Rodrigo trusts him. Rodrigo is the first character we meet with Iago, and Rodrigo trusts him. And what Shakespeare is doing is establishing this notion that Iago is trusted by the people he will completely destroy. Remember that by the end of the play, Iago is going to stick a knife into Rodrigo's guts. But at this moment, Rodrigo trusts him. And again, Shakespeare's setting us up in this belief that Iago is somebody who is trusted.
Leanne Carroll of the Sacred Heart School, Tullamore. I follow him to serve my turn upon him, Iago. This is where we see Iago reveal his intentions, his manipulative plan. It is a very interesting quote as it introduces a theme of revenge and deception and Iago's corrupt nature.
Rodrigo, after all this, gets to the nub of the matter, the real point of the conversation, which is the elopement of Desdemona to Othello. Rodrigo is in love with Desdemona. Oh, he's so in love, but totally incapable of walking up to her and saying, I really fancy you, can we go out for dinner? Couldn't do it, hasn't got the ability, hasn't got the strength of character. He's just weak. So what he's done is he's employed Iago to do his courting for him, to send the messages, to send the pretty presents, to send the jewels, the boxes of chocolates, and all the other things. And Iago is telling Rodrigo all the time, yeah, I'm doing it. She really fancies you, she really does. Rodrigo, being a fool, hasn't the courage to take advantage of that piece of information and walk up to her. Then he hears that she's run away with Othello, and he is extremely contemptuous of Othello's color.
What a full fortune does the thick lips owe if he can carry it thus.
Call up her father, rouse him, make after him, poison his delight, proclaim him in the streets. Though that his joy be joy, yet throw such change of vexation on't as it may lose some colour.
I'll call aloud.
Do with like timorous accent and dire yell.
Now, interesting little scene there, or little sequence. What a full fortune does the thick lips owe. Othello is black. The Moor. There's a lot of debate as to whether he was, you know, what did that mean? Was he Berber? Was he Arabic? Was he what? He was Negroid. There was in Elizabethan England, and at that time, a huge influx of Africans into London. In fact, Queen Elizabeth I complained about the number who were taking up and buying houses. They were actually doing terribly well. They came in as traders. And there was contempt, there was racism as much then as there is now. And the term thick lips would have been considered grossly insulting and highly descriptive. And it's important because this racism is another theme that stays with us in the play. Iago suggests that the best solution to the elopement, on the assumption that they haven't yet got married and consummated it, is to get the father going, to get the father out chasing them. So that phrase, call up her father, rouse him, is quite literally, let's take to the streets, let's cause a riot. Make after him, the him there refers to Othello. Follow him, poison his delight, proclaim him in the streets. Though did his joy be joy, throw such changes of vexation on it that it may lose some color. And again, Shakespeare is using that color in both senses, in the sense that we will discolor his delight, but also that it's a direct reference to Othello's blackness. But the idea is Iago is encouraging Rodrigo to create a riot in the streets about this abduction, because that's what they're going to suggest it is. Not an elopement, but an abduction. A black man and a white girl. Iago is quite savage about it, but very clever. He brings Rodrigo to Brabantio's house, where Rodrigo will inform on Desdemona. He'll split. He'll tell the story.
What ho, Brabantio? Signor Brabantio, ho. Awake. What ho, Brabantio? Thieves, thieves, thieves. Look to your house, your daughter, and your bags. Thieves, thieves,
thieves.
Thieves, thieves, thieves. There were no police in Elizabethan England. There were no burglar alarms, and there wasn't any street lighting. So if somebody came banging on your door and saying you've been robbed, there are thieves about, you really did worry, and you reacted instantly. You'd go out with a sword and attack anybody who was trying to steal anything you had. So this is really quite serious. This attack on Brabantio, this proclaiming from the street, get up, there's a serious problem with your house, you have been robbed, would get an instant and very violent response.
What is the reason of this terrible summons?
Signor, is all your family within?
Are your doors locked?
Why? Wherefore ask you this?
Zounds, sir, you're robbed. For shame, put on your gown. Your heart is burst, you have lost half your soul. Even now, now, very now, an old black ram is topping your white ewe. Arise, arise. Awake the snorting citizens with the bell, or else the devil will make a grandsire of you. Arise, I say.
Iago, under the cover of darkness, without ever revealing himself, starts a riot. Look at the way he uses words. And Iago is has a great skill at the use of repetition. And you'll find that again throughout the play. Your heart is, but you've lost half your soul. Even now, now, very now, an old black ram is tupping your white yo. Now, now, very now, right at this moment, while we're talking about it, guess what's happening to your daughter? Even as you're standing here, right at this moment, he's doing it to her. It's a very, very potent image, isn't it? It's happening right now. Iago is brilliant. He puts the fear of God into Brabantio. That's his daughter and an old black ram. An old black ram. He's really rousing Brabantio's anger. And he's throwing a few insults at Othello for good measure. Old black ram and devil. They're all planted here by Shakespeare because those three terms of description are going to reappear in the play. Old, black, devil. But Iago must also appear loyal to Othello. So he leaves Rodrigo to deal with the outraged father. And he slips off, quietly, to become Othello's trusted ensign again. Nobody on the street, including Brabantio, knows that Iago was behind this. The only person that Brabantio actually sees, or who identifies himself, is Rodrigo. Iago stays safe. So, thank you for readings from Alan Reynolds, who read Brabantio, John Hines, who read Rodrigo, and Lars Amussen, who read Iago, all from Colossus Aquilum.
Elizabeth Taff, Sacred Heart School, Tullamore. My favourite character is Iago. He's very smart and manipulates the other characters very well.
He is ruthless in his quest to seek revenge on Othello, and this creates a lot of conflict and deception in the play. I knew he was capable of extreme cruelty, and this was very intriguing.
Farewell, for I must leave you. It seems not meet nor wholesome to my place to be produced, as, if I stay, I shall, against the Moor, in which regard, though I do hate him as I do hell pains, yet, for necessity of present life, I must cheer out a flag and sign of love, which is indeed but sign. That you shall surely find him, lead to the Sagittar, the raised search, and there will I be with him, so farewell.
Very clever indeed. He says, I have to go off. I have to go and be his friend. I have to go and look after him. I have to go and be on his side, because he pays my wages. He's my boss. I have to do this, but I still hate him. Don't ever doubt that I hate him. Making sure that Rodrigo is in no doubt whatsoever that Iago is on his side. And the moment he meets Othello, Iago is all honest friend, advising, being incredibly supportive, making sure that Othello is okay, that he's done the right thing, that he's fine with what's going to happen.
But I pray you, sir, are you fast married? Be sure of this, but that Brabantio is much beloved, and hath in his effect a voice potential as double as the Duke's. He will divorce you.
Let him do his spite. My services which I have done the Signory shall out-tongue his complaints. I fetch my life and being from men of royal siege, and my demerits may speak unbonneted to as proud a fortune as this that I have reached. For know, Iago, but that I love the gentle Desdemona, I would not my unhoused free condition put into circumscription and confine for the sea's worth.
In this first speech by Othello, he tells us that he is not a savage, that he's a man of position and authority, a man, in fact, of royal blood, which is a very important point for an Elizabethan audience who would probably have looked upon a black man as being an inferior being. It's also important that he emphasizes to the audience that he has not abducted Desdemona, but married her for love. It is terribly important, because all we've had planted in our minds by Iago is that this, and Rodrigo, is that this is an abduction, that this is sneaking away in the night with the white girl. So from the moment Othello comes onto the stage, he establishes his moral authority. He is an honest, decent man. He is a man of respect. He is a man of royal lineage. He is a man of position and rank, equivalent to anybody else in Venice. Remember, Iago said, Brabantio is much beloved and hath a voice potential as double as the Duke's. In other words, Brabantio is a man of position and authority and rank, and the Duke will listen to him. And it's terribly important we understand that Othello considers himself the equal of any of them.
My name is John Lydon. I'm a teacher in Colossia Cullum and Tullamore in County Offaly. And the question I looked at was, jealousy is one of the predominant themes in the play Othello by William Shakespeare, discussed referring closely to the text in your answer. For an opening, I might suggest what I often say to my own pupils, to rewrite the title in your own words, saying if you agree or disagree. This makes you think what really is being asked in the question. It's helpful to maybe establish a context then. Maybe jealousy as a flaw which plays a large part in the tragic hero's downfall. You might observe that the theme is strengthened by the jealousy of other characters, such as Iago, Bianco, and Bianca, and Rodrigo. It's important maybe to point out there are different types of jealousy present, such as personal, professional, and sexual jealousy, and also that jealousy is always seen as being destructive. You might perhaps begin with Iago, as he's the instigator of much of the jealousy in the play. We see sexual jealousy by Iago of Othello and Cassio. We see professional jealousy of Cassio and personal jealousy of anybody he perceives as his better. He refers to it as a pestilence or a poisonous mineral that gnaws at my innards. About Emilia's infidelity with Othello, he says, "Twixt my sheets he has done my office." And again about his wife Emilia and Cassio, he says, "I fear Cassio with my nightcap too." For professional jealousy of Cassio, he says, "One Michael Cassio, a Florentine, a fellow most damned in a fair wife, that never set a squadron in the field, nor the division of a battle knows. Ultimately, the jealousy destroys Iago. As a link to Othello, you might suggest that this knowledge of jealousy, his own knowledge of jealousy, is put to good use against Othello. He says, "Yet that I put the Moor at least into a jealousy so strong that judgment cannot cure." Getting on to Othello then, it's important to establish that it is part of his fatal flaw. Iago says, "Trifles light as air are to the jealous confirmation strong." Iago uses the fact that Othello is an outsider to convince him that Venice women are unfaithful. Some discussion of the temptation scene would be vital, where Iago tempts Othello. Some reference to the idea of tragic hero, where jealousy has brought Othello from being a noble Moor and a complete man, according to Ludovico, to a coarse, vulgar and debased man. Some quotes that you might use from the third act might be, "I'll tear her to pieces about Desdemona," or "Arise, black vengeance from hollow hell." And again, talking about Cassio and Desdemona, he says, "As prime as goats, as hot as monkeys." He sums himself up at the end, not objectively, in the last scene, of one not easily jealous, but being wrought perplexed in the extreme. And again, jealousy ultimately destroys Othello.
Brabantio turns up on the scene with a small but extremely riotous mob, and they are here to arrest Othello. They are here to drag him in, literally to drag him to jail for abduction. Brabantio arrives in great anger. This image in his head, now, an old black ram is topping your white yoke. That image is very strong in his head, and he's going to put a stop to it now. So you've got this big gang coming onto the streets with swords and flaming torches, and you get that wonderful sense that in the dark streets of Venice, suddenly this mad crowd appears, led by this extremely red-faced and angry and roaring father. And Othello shows enormous calm and authority. He demonstrates that he is noble and that he is not afraid of the rabble's weapons.
"Keep up your bright swords, for the dew will rust them. Good signor, you shall more command with years than with your weapons."
"O thou foul thief, where hast thou stowed my daughter? Damned as thou art, thou hast enchanted her. For I'll refer me to all things of sense, if she in chains of magic were not bound, whether a maid so tender, fair, and happy, so opposite to marriage that she shunned the wealthy curled darlings of our nation, would ever have, to incur a general mock, run from her guardage to the sooty bosom of such a thing as thou, to fear, not to delight. Judge me the world if 'tis not gross in sense that thou hast practised on her with foul charms, abused her delicate youth with drugs or minerals that weaken motion. I'll half dispute it on. 'Tis probable and palpable to thinking. I therefore apprehend and do attach thee for an abuser of the world, a practiser of arts inhibited and out of warrant. Lay hold upon him."
Now you can see, actually, the contrast between the two characters there. You have the extremely noble senator, a man who is a lawmaker of Venice, a man who is esteemed as of rank and position and authority in the city. And then you can see the man that is despised, Black Othello. Black Othello, faced with a riotous mob, says very calmly, "Put up your bright swords, for the dew will rust them." He is contemptuous of them. He says, "You don't frighten me with your swords." It's a beautiful line. It's Shakespeare at his very cleverest. He's saying, it's like a standoff in one of those westerns, you know, where the gunfighters are all looking at one another. It's like Good, Bad, and the Ugly, where the eyes are going back and forward across the screen. Who's going to pull first? Who's going to draw? Who's going to shoot? Othello would be wonderful in a gunfight, because he'd just stand there and say, "Okay, make your move." Nothing phases him. He is a real soldier. He has real nobility. He has real control. Brabantio, on the other hand, the senator, is red-faced, angry, and bullying. He doesn't walk in and say, "Would you care to answer some questions concerning what you've done with my daughter? Oh, thou foul thief." Straight away. Now, you can understand it. His daughter has run away, and she's run away with a man old enough to be her father, and black. So he's rather upset. But then he goes further. Damned as thou art, you are damned. That's a terrible thing in Elizabethan society, to make the assumption that someone is damned. Thou hast enchanted her. Well, we all like to think, don't we, chaps, that we can enchant ladies. But he doesn't mean it in that sense. For I refer me to all things of sense, if she in chains of magic were not bound, now it's getting serious. Whether a maid so tender, fair, and happy, opposite to marriage, that she shunned the wealthy, curled darlings of our city, all the pretty young boys didn't have a chance with her. Would ever have to, now this is where it really gets meaty, to incur a general mock, to have everyone pointing at her and laughing at her, would run from her guardage, me, her father, to the sooty bosom of such a thing as thou. Boy, that's insulting. A thing as thou, sooty bosom. Black comes into it again. You are a lesser being, a thing as thou. He is really turning the screw of hatred and bile and racism. Judge me the world if 'tis not gross incense that thou hast practiced on her with foul charms, abused her delicate youth with drugs or minerals that weaken motion. In other words, he believes that a child of his couldn't possibly have gone off with someone like Othello unless he actually bewitched her. He accuses Othello of witchcraft, kidnapping, sorcery, and just about anything else he can think of. Now, that's a serious charge in Elizabethan England, a very, very serious charge. And he demands that Othello appear immediately before the Duke to answer those charges. Ironically, just before that, Othello has been summoned by the Duke for a very, very different reason. Cyprus, one of the Venetian colonies, is now under threat of attack by the Turks. The state of Venice needs Othello. The Duke, the senators, need Othello very, very badly. They need a general. And there's no one else available to send as governor to protect the island. So at the moment, when Brabantio wants to drag him before the Duke as a witch, a sorcerer, a kidnapper, and a drug pusher, right? The Duke wants Othello there as a general and savior of Cyprus. That's Shakespeare being brilliantly ironic.
Caitlin Rigney from Sacred Heart School. My favorite scene is Act 1, Scene 3. This scene showcases the law and order of the Venetian state and how highly these qualities are valued there. This creates a contrast with the war-torn Cyprus. At the same time, Desdemona's love for Othello is depicted in this scene. She shows herself to be very brave when she stands before the Senate. It is as a result of this bravery and ability to speak for herself in a male-dominated environment that this is my favourite scene.
Valiant Othello, we must straight employ you against the general enemy, Ottoman. I did not see you. Welcome, gentle senior. We lacked your counsel and your help tonight.
So did I yours, for my particular grief is of so floodgate and o'erbearing nature that it engluts and swallows other sorrows, and it is still itself. My daughter, oh my daughter, she is abused, stolen from me and corrupted by spells and medicines bought of mountebanks. For nature so preposterously to err, being not deficient, blind or lame of sense, sans witchcraft could not.
And there is the accusation. In front of the Duke, in front of the Senate, witchcraft. And it's very, very serious. In Elizabethan England, witchcraft was punishable by death. If you were proven to be a witch, you'd be hanged. And witch, in this sense, is not necessarily female. To be a witch, you could be either sex. You could be male or female, it didn't matter. Once you were accused of it, once it was proven against you, they would take you out and hang you. They really did believe. So Shakespeare is making a very, very serious threat here to Othello. But there's a problem. If Brabantio proves his accusation, Venice will have no general to go and fight the Turks. And this is a real problem for the Duke and Senate. Here, the one man they can rely on, their other general, is away on holiday. Okay? Because the first thing that the Duke says is, Marcus Lusikos, is he not in town? No, he's gone somewhere else. Oh, well. Oh, thank God, here's a fellow. We'll use him. The fact is, the Duke needs Othello as a living general, not as a dead witch. So the Duke asks him to explain himself. And he does. He explains himself with incredible clarity how, to his own amazement, Desdemona fell in love with him and he with her. But Shakespeare is very clever because he uses, and remember, Othello's been accused of witchcraft, accused of being an enchanter. And Shakespeare gives Othello a speech that uses enchantment through words to tell his story. And points out that it was Brabantio who first brought him to meet Desdemona. Brabantio invited him into his house. Brabantio asked him to tell stories of his life. And he tells them, and it tells them in the most wonderfully, in a way that is fascinating to listen to. It's almost hypnotic. Wherein I spake of most disastrous chances of moving accidents by flood and field, of hairbreadth scapes in the imminent deadly breach, of being taken by the insolent foe and sold to slavery, of my redemption thence. And he goes on and on and on. Of Antres vast and deserts idle, rough quarries, rocks and hills, whose heads did touch heaven. It was my hint to speak. And he's painting this wonderful picture of this romantic, almost, if it were a movie, it would have Brad Pitt playing the part, or Denzel Washington, probably. But it's this image of this incredibly romantic history of a man who's traveled the world and been through incredible experiences, who's been sold to slavery, who's worked his freedom and eventually, and been all over the world. He talks about the cannibals that each other eat, the anthropophagi, and men whose heads do grow beneath their shoulders. And that Desdemona used to listen to him. And she'd be running around doing the housework and cleaning up the dishes and looking after the house. But she'd sneak back and ask her to tell more of it. Ask Othello to tell her more of it. And he would. And they'd sit and they'd talk and she'd listen. And eventually she said, if you know somebody like that who could love me, tell him I could love him. Which is a woman saying, I really fancy you, without actually saying it, because she's modest. And he realized she was in love with him. And he realized he was in love with her. She loved me for the dangers I had passed, and I loved her that she did pity them. This only is the witchcraft I have used. And so, cleverly, Othello says, it was witchcraft. Brabantio's right. I did use witchcraft, but I used the witchcraft of my own life. I used the witchcraft of my own words, and that's what she fell in love with. Me, my life, my words. And because she loved me for what I am, I loved her. It's a magic piece of writing by Shakespeare. Thank you to Darren Mahan, who read Othello, Adam O'Doherty, who read The Duke, and to John Hines, who read Brabantio.
I'm Conor Clark, and I go to Colossacombe, Tullamore. My favourite part of Othello is in Act 3, Scene 3, when Desdemona attempts to reconcile Othello's relationship with Cassio. Iago's well-timed entrance with Othello paints the general's wife and Cassio in a bad light, and Iago's power of suggestion furthers the seed of doubt already in Othello's mind. This scene is an excellent example of jealousy in the play. Look to your wife, observe her well with Cassio. Wear your eyes thus, not jealous nor secure. I would not have your free and open nature out of self-bounty be abused.
Anyway, back to the courtroom. Back to the Duke. There's only one solution. Desdemona is sent for and asked by her father to explain herself before the Duke.
I pray you, hear her speak. If she confessed that she was half the wooer, destruction on my head if my bad blame light on the man. Come hither, gentle mistress. Do you perceive in all this noble company where most you owe obedience?
My noble father, I do perceive here a divided duty. To you I am bound for life and education. My life and education both do learn me how to respect you. You are the lord of duty. I am hitherto your daughter, but here is my husband. And so much duty as my mother showed to you, preferring you before her father, so much I challenge that I may profess, due to the Moor, my lord.
Brabantio is trapped by his own words into agreeing to the marriage. And to an extent, he's made to look rather foolish by his daughter and his new and extremely unwanted son-in-law. She condemns her father with his own words. You are the lord of duty. You have educated me. You have told me that I must follow my duty. You have instilled in me obedience. And he says, okay, point out, who in this room do you most owe obedience to? The way you've taught me, Dad. You taught me to obey you when you were my father. But you expected my mother to obey you when she left her father. Once she became your husband, her duty was to you. So I'm doing exactly what you believe. I've now got a husband, and my duty is to him, not you. And there's no arguing with that. Brabantio cannot have it both ways. She has said in open court, in front of the Duke, you're not my boss anymore. The black man in the corner is my boss, because he's my husband and I love him. And the argument is finished. It's quite brilliant. In one single swoop, she manages to gain her freedom and to gain recognition of her marriage by using her father's own rule book. Very clever writing. Now, having got rid of the problem of Othello as a witch and abduction and got all of that out of the way with one very simple sweep of logic, and it's, of course, the logic of a woman that finally breaks the deadlock. It usually is. Now the plot returns to the question of Cyprus. Othello must go immediately. Immediately. Now. Tonight. Now the question arises, what to do with Desdemona? Where's she going to live? Her father won't take her back, but she's the one who proposes a very unusual solution.
That I did love the Moor to live with him. My downright violence and scorn of fortunes may trumpet to the world. My heart subdued even to the utmost pleasure of my lord. I saw Othello's visage in his mind, and to his honour and his valiant parts did I my soul and fortunes consecrate. So that, dear lords, if I be left behind, a moth of peace, and he go to the war, the rights for which I love him are bereft me, and I a heavy interim shall support by his dear absence. Let me go with him.
That I did love the Moor to live with him. He's not just my friend, he's not just somebody I admire, he's not just somebody I quite like to have coffee with. He's the man I love. I want to be his wife. My heart subdued even to the utmost pleasure of my lord. In other words, in Elizabethan terminology, I am dedicated to him and whatever he wants. And then a very important statement. I saw Othello's visage in his mind. Visage, face. You can see a black man. I see a man. I saw Othello's visage in his mind. She didn't see him as being black. She didn't see him as being old. All she saw was a man that she loves. And it's the first time in the play that somebody has stood up and say, his color is irrelevant. His age is irrelevant. He is a man and I love him. Very powerful moment. And thank you to Eva Spain from Sacred Heart School and to John Hines from Colossia Column for reading Desdemona and Brabantio.
My name is Joanne Butler from the Sacred Heart Secondary School in Tullamore. And I'm going to discuss the struggle between good and evil in Shakespeare's Othello. From the onset, evil is clearly depicted in the play Othello. The opening scene introduces us to a disgruntled Iago who is hatching plans of revenge. I follow him to serve my turn upon him. He admits that his loyalty to Othello is feigned and tells Rodrigo that he merely puts on shows of service. Therefore, as early as the first scene, Iago establishes himself as the embodiment of evil in the play. His language reflects his baseness. He constantly refers to the devil and uses animal imagery. Divinity of hell. An old black ram is tooping your white ewe. You'll have your daughter covered with a Burberry horse. Will as tenderly be led by the nose as asses are, but to mention a few examples. In contrast, Othello's first speeches are more eloquent and polite, depicting him as a character who represents good. My parts, my title, and my perfect soul shall manifest me rightly. Initially, Othello makes many references to God and Christianity. Now by heaven. However, it must be noted that as Othello becomes corrupted by Iago, his language changes dramatically. His initial greetings of quiet Desdemona, this fair lady, my fair warrior, changed to horrific derogatory references such as whore, lewd minx, fair devil. Significantly, like Iago, he also alludes constantly to hellish imagery, death and damnation, damn her. His language becomes suffocatingly dark and sinister as he changes with Iago's poison. My name is now begrimed and black, black vengeance. Othello's language also becomes brutally violent. I will chop her into messes. I'll tear her all to pieces. Highlighting his inability to deal with his emotions rationally and the intense passion he feels for his relationship with Desdemona, a relationship which the cunning Iago abuses for his own ends. And just as Iago portrays true evil, at the other end of the spectrum, pure goodness is embodied by Desdemona. By her father's own admission, she was a maiden never bold of spirit, so still and quiet. Othello similarly refers to her as gentle and fair, while Cassio calls her virtuous Desdemona. Everything she does and says confirms her to be a good person. Her efforts to have Cassio reinstated are born purely from kindness. Her pleas of reason to Othello are honest and heartfelt. I have not deserved this.
And now we come to the quiz. And our contestants are Coco Sweeney from Wilson's Hospital. We have Aisling Walsh from Tullamore College. We have Shauna Payton from Sacred Heart School. And we have David Carroll from Cailleach de Colum. Now, the first round is an audio round. I'm going to play to you some soundtrack from the play, and I'm going to ask each of you in turn to identify who is speaking to who. The first is for you, Coco.
That never set a squadron in a field, nor the division of a battle knows more than a spinster. This countercaster. He, in good time, must his lieutenant be, and I, God bless the mark, his moorship's ancient.
By heaven, I rather would have been his hangman.
So, Coco, who is talking to who?
Rodrigo and Iago.
Yes, Rodrigo and Iago. Well done. That's a Thanks. Point for Wilson's Hospital. Now, Aisling, here's yours.
Even now, very now. An old black ram is tapping your white ewe. Arise, arise! Awake the snorting citizens with the bell, or else the devil will make a grandsire of you. Arise, I say!
What? Have you lost your wits?
Who's talking to who?
Brabantio and Rodrigo.
Brabantio and...
Iago.
Oh, Iago, yes. I'll allow you that one. Iago is talking to Brabantio. Shauna, here's yours.
The Duke does greet you, General, and he requires your haste, post-haste appearance, even on the instant.
What is the matter, think you?
Something from Cyprus, as I may divine.
Cassio and Othello?
Cassio and?
Othello.
Othello. Well done. And David.
Look to her, Boer, if thou hast eyes to see. She has deceived her father, and may thee.
My life upon her faith.
That's an easy one.
Iago and Othello.
You've got it half right.
Uh,
I'll tell you what, I'll give you half a point for that one, since you got it half right. It is, in fact, Brabantio and Othello. And now we move on to the buzzer round. If you know the answer, press the buzzer, and I'll ask you for it. First question. Shakespeare's play Othello is set in two different locations. Name one of them. And that is David from Colossia Column.
Cyprus.
It's Cyprus and Venice, yes. Cyprus is good enough. Who are about to invade Cyprus at the beginning of the play? David is flying away and...
The Turks.
The Turks, correct. What does Amelia steal from Desdemona?
A neckerchief.
A handkerchief?
Handkerchief.
Yes. No, what did you say?
Handkerchief.
Yes, well done. What? This is a political question. What line from Othello did Charlie Haughey quote? Sorry? Aisling from Tullamore got in first.
I did the state some service.
I have done the state some service, correct.
Oh, come on.
Who is the very rose of purest passion? And it's Aisling again.
Desdemona.
How does Othello kill? And it's Coco.
He smothers her.
What is Desdemona's father's name? David.
Brabantio.
Brabantio is correct. You've got to be quick with those fingers. Why does Iago resent Cassio? Who was that? I think Shauna was actually in.
Yeah, was.
Because Othello made him lieutenant.
That's right. He was passed over in favor of Cassio. What prevents the Turks from actually... And it's...
Storms at sea.
Can I finish the question? What prevents the Turks from attacking Cyprus?
Storms at sea.
Well done. Why does Othello become jealous of Desdemona and Cassio?
Because they think he thinks they're having an affair.
That's correct. And that appalling whistle... And that appalling whistle tells us that that is over. That's the end of the quiz. And the result is, in joint third place, Wilson's Hospital and Sacred Heart. In second place, with 4.5 points, is Colossia Column. And the winners are Tullamore College with 5 points. So, all the players are now in Cyprus. Shakespeare's brought it all together into this one place. All the protagonists are there. We know who they are. We know what they are about. And now, in a sense, the play begins. Because everything up to this point has almost been like a prologue, telling you who the characters are, telling you what the relationships are, and implanting very, very clearly in the audience's mind what the relationships are. Telling us very clearly that Desdemona is absolutely in love with Othello. Telling us that Othello is absolutely besotted with Desdemona. Telling us that Rodrigo absolutely fancies Desdemona. Telling us that Cassio is a true and loyal soldier. And telling us that Iago is not to be trusted and is the most dishonest character in the play. That everybody trusts and believes honest. And that's the most vital thing to understand. That everybody in the play trusts Iago. One of the great mistakes that's often made when actors play Iago is that they play to play him like a villain. That you cast somebody in the part who looks like a villain. The whole point is that he looks like an angel. The whole point is that he looks and behaves like an honest man. That's the man to distrust. The one who looks most honest. And Iago looks most honest and is most dishonest. So, the scene is set, and Iago is now going to put his plan into action. He's going to cause a small riot. He's going to put Cassio in a position of responsibility, and he's going to cause a fight. And hopefully that will be enough to tilt the balance against Cassio. It's a matter of careful control. but he knows something about Cassio that we don't know. So he gets Rodrigo, who has arrived disguised in Cyprus, gets Rodrigo to agree to start the fight.
Watch you tonight, for the command I laid upon you. Cassio knows you not. I'll not be far from you. Do you find some occasion to anger Cassio?
Well.
Sir, he is rash and very sudden in choler, and haply may strike at you. Provoke him, that he may, for even out of that will I cause these of Cyprus to mutiny, whose qualification shall come into no true taste again but by the displanting of Cassio. So shall you have a shorter journey to your desires.
I will do this, if you can bring it to any opportunity.
I warrant thee. Farewell.
And so the stage is set. And if it succeeds, the plan will ensure that Cassio is dismissed and leave the field open for Iago. If he can get Cassio to fight, to have a brawl with some ordinary civilian, it makes him look bad in Othello's eyes. And that's all the plan is for the moment. The plan develops step by step. The only plan at the moment is to get Cassio angry enough to attack a civilian. And that will be enough. Iago now explains to the audience, and almost to himself, how this plan is developing.
That Cassio loves her, I do well believe it. That she loves him, 'tis apt and of great credit.
Now, at that point, he's almost spelling it out again for the audience. This is where we are. This is what we know. This is how we're going about things. Simple statements. I think Cassio is in love with Desdemona. There's no reason to suspect that Iago is lying there. It is a reasonable supposition. She's gorgeous. It's reasonable to suppose that Cassio fancies her.
The Moor, howbeit that I endure him not, is of a constant, loving, noble nature, and I dare think he'll prove to Desdemona a most dear husband.
So, having established that he thinks Cassio loves her, he now establishes quite clearly that Othello loves her and will be true to her.
Now, I do love her too.
And that's the interesting revelation. I think she's gorgeous too. I love her too. So we've got another potential level of jealousy on Iago's part. It's never been revealed before. He's never mentioned it before. But he rather fancies her as well.
My name's Kieran MacFarland from Clash Cullum. Iago's character, in my opinion, is the most interesting one in Othello. He uses all of his sadistic powers to get what he wants. He does this by poisoning the mind of Othello. For instance, he convinces Othello that he heard Cassio say, "Sweet Desdemona, let us be wary, let us hide our loves," while Cassio was asleep. It is through his pure evilness and cunning that allows this lie, and the many lies before it, to convince Othello that he has been betrayed and gives him the motive to kill everyone dear to him.
Not out of absolute lust, though peradventure I stand accountant for as great a sin, but partly led to diet my revenge, for that I do suspect a lusty Moor hath leapt into my seat. The thought whereof doth, like a poisonous mineral, gnaw my inwards, and nothing can or shall content my soul till I am evened with him, wife for wife.
Now there you are, there you have it. Yet again, he says, I think the Moor has slept with my wife. His desire for Desdemona is tempered by that, for revenge. He is jealous of Othello. He suspects him. He suspects his wife of infidelity. There is no evidence to suggest it whatsoever. And at no point in the play does Shakespeare ever hint that such a thing ever occurred. It is just in Iago's mind, but it's enough to gnaw at his mind. It's enough to feed his diet for revenge. The thought whereof doth like a poisonous mineral gnaw my innards. Jealousy is a very, very savage, cruel master.
Or failing so, yet that I put the Moor at least into a jealousy so strong that judgment cannot cure. Which thing to do? If this poor trash of Venice, whom I trash for his quick hunting, stand the putting on, I'll have our Michael Cassio on the hip, abuse him to the Moor in the rank garb, for I fear Cassio with my nightcap too.
Another one. He now thinks that Cassio has been sleeping with Amelia. The man is completely and totally unreasonable. He's grasping these ideas out of the air. He's almost feeding his own doubt, feeding his own jealousy. He'll begin to think that the ship's cat is sleeping with her soon enough. He's obsessed with this idea, and it builds and it builds, because once an obsession like this builds in an intelligent mind, the mind becomes devious. The mind starts seeking out evil.
Make the Moor thank me, love me, and reward me for making him egregiously an ass and practicing upon his peace and quiet even to madness. 'Tis here but yet confused. Knavery's plain face is never seen till used.
And that is the beauty of Iago's plan. To make the Moor thank me, love me, and reward me for making him a complete idiot. That's the genius of Iago. That he will do these dreadful things and have everybody believe that he's the decent man. He will never be suspected. He will never be considered the villain. And that for all the bad things he does, he'll make sure somebody else gets the blame and he gets the thanks. And he finishes it with that interesting phrase, 'tis here, it's in my mind, but yet confused. I haven't fully worked it out yet. I know what I want to do. I know the first step towards how to go about it. And I know the reasons I want to do it. But I haven't yet fully formulated the plot. Knavery's plain face is never seen till used. Quite simply, I'll just keep quiet for a moment. I won't let anybody see what I'm about. Sooner or later, it'll come. But that's for the next program. And thank you to John Hines and to Adam O'Doherty from Colossian Column for reading those excerpts.
Like a desert needs rain, like a town needs a name, I need your love.
That was Othello in Offaly with me, Alan Stanford. And we'd like to thank the students and staff of Colossian Column, Wilson's Hospital School, Tullamore College, and our hosts, Sacred Heart School. Sound supervision was by Pat Hogan, and the production team was Fanula Hayes, Liam O'Brien, Catherine Brennan, and Kevin Reynolds.